We didn't stick to our guns quite enough, and so in the earliest stages, people were telling us, you really need to have experimentation in here, or you really need a mobile offering as well. And so, for example, we hired contractors to do a mobile SDK for LaunchDarkly, and the first version of it was just not very good. It's really hard. Like we realized early on that our SDKs are pretty mission critical, and the quality of them has to be top notch. They have to feel really native. They can't have any bugs. They can't introduce massive performance overhead. Relying on a third party to build that, just, it really doesn't work. My name is John Kodamal. I'm the CTO and co-founder of LaunchDarkly.
This is Code Story, the podcast bringing you interviews with tech visionaries who share in the critical moments of what it takes to change an industry and build and lead a team that has your back.
I'm your host, Noah Labhart, and today how John Kodamal built the number one platform to release your product using feature flags.
All this and more on Code Story.
John Kodamal grew up really into computers, and he's old enough that during his childhood it was abnormal to be so into computers. To illustrate just how much he was into computers, he told me a story about how he taught himself to touch type in grade school using the Dvorak keyboard layout. He's a family man with two children, a 7-year-old daughter and a 5-year-old son. And outside of family, he has a ton of hobbies and interests, including climbing. In fact, his last trip before COVID hit, he took a bunch of friends and coworkers to ice climb in Colorado. Over his entire career, John has been thinking about ways to deliver software better. He did a PhD in programming languages, and he worked at Atlassian for a number of years. When he got connected with his co-founder, Edith Harbaugh, they started to explore just how big of an opportunity they had around feature flags. This is the creation story of LaunchDarkly.
So LaunchDarkly is a feature management platform. Simply speaking, it allows software developers, product managers, anyone involved in building software to leverage feature flags to do a lot of things. The simplest use cases, a lot of the value proposition is around being able to mitigate risk around software releases. So you can, for example, when you're launching a new code change or a new feature out into production, historically, pre-LaunchDarkly, you would just deploy it, and your entire user base would see it all at once. We've realized that that's a pretty risky practice, and a better practice as an engineering team is to do gradual rollouts. Feature flags are one mechanism to do that, and LaunchDarkly is a platform that takes feature flags and elevates it from a thing that you flip on in your database that only your developers know about to a full-on collaboration platform where everybody that is involved peripherally or can get value out of using feature flags has access to the tool. So a product manager can define a release schedule for a beta feature and be able to run that release process themselves without having to involve engineering. So my co-founder and I, Edith Harbaugh and I, we iterated on a handful of ideas, and ultimately my entire career I've been thinking about ways to deliver software better. I did a PhD in programming languages, specifically interested in finding defects in software automatically. I worked at Atlassian for a number of years. I realized that this was kind of the area that I knew best, and Edith has a really strong background in the developer space as well. And so we looked around and found an opportunity to build this product. We didn't necessarily know how big of an idea it was, but we wanted to explore it. And from a technical perspective, we kind of just dove right in. Some of the initial ideas that I had around the architecture of the product, how it would work, like the idea of having SDKs that customers download and insert into their applications, the idea of doing the feature flag evaluation, the assignment of whether or not someone gets the true variation or a false variation to a feature flag, and doing that all in memory with no performance overhead, we figured that part out in sort of week one. From a tech perspective, I had had a long background in functional programming. I'd done a lot of stuff with Scala, Scala Z, and even Haskell at previous work. But for LaunchDarkly, sort of deliberately chose to use Go as the technology stack. And some of those technology decisions, for example, like the use of Go, the structure of our first monolith, the breakdown into some of the microservices that we have, all of those occurred kind of at the earliest phase. So the first repository we created at LaunchDarkly, the first code I wrote, I think it's still in production now. I mean, it's probably just main at this point, right? But it's still in production at this point.
Well, let's dig into that a little bit. So tell me about the MVP. You mentioned some of the tools, but I may get you to reiterate on them. So tell me about what sort of tools you used and how long it took you to build.
You know, I'm primarily a back-end developer, and so one of the biggest challenges was when we started the company, it was just me and my co-founder. I was the only one, you know, hands-on keyboard writing code, and I don't really know much about the front end. And so I picked the simplest technology that I could from the front end perspective just to get something out the door. So we used Angular on the front end. The first line of Go code I wrote was literally like the main application for LaunchDarkly. So we used Go, we used Angular, and we knew pretty early on that we wanted that this was going to be a pretty high scale service if we were successful. So we chose Fastly as a CDN technology, and this was back in like 2015. So Fastly was still a pretty young emerging CDN provider, but we knew we needed to do certain things, very efficiently, including things like purging CDN caches. So we picked Fastly as a technology because it was sort of like, I kind of viewed it as Varnish as a service. And Varnish, you know, has this ability to like really, in a detailed way in VCL, specify how the CDN layer should behave. And then it can also like purge extremely rapidly, in the order of milliseconds or seconds, which was an important capability for us. So those were some of the early technology decisions. We were also, you know, from an operational perspective, I didn't have a ton of time to dig deep into AWS. And so as a shortcut, we were deployed on DigitalOcean for a while. We eventually migrated into AWS and now are heavy consumers of many of AWS's services.
So in that early, you know, product you mentioned, you know, what sort of decisions and trade-offs did you have to make? Dig into some of those about technical debt, feature cut. You mentioned DigitalOcean. There's probably some stories there, but what sort of decisions and trade-offs did you have to make, and how did you cope with them?
From an operational perspective, the whole service was designed to sort of like let one operator get it up and going and then maintain it. And so we took a lot of shortcuts from an operational perspective. A lot of the tooling was just around what could I deploy easily and efficiently and be iterating on the product space and not iterating on the operational side as much. From the product capability perspective, we knew there was a lot that we had to build eventually. But we really, this was category creation. I mean, a product like this didn't really exist in the commercial space. There were a lot of open source tools. There were a lot of things in the commercial space that focused on A/B testing. And a lot of the pushback we got from early customers was, why isn't this A/B testing? And we really had to define what the difference was, what the unique needs were when you were thinking about feature management versus specifically optimization focused A/B testing, different user personas, different needs. And so the early product, we focused on showing that first delta of value. We knew that we'd be heavily used on the server side, even though a lot of people, customers, investors were telling us, you know, you need to focus on mobile and client side because that's where the web is today. And we realized actually like this is something that we expect development teams to use in terms of like how they develop all of their code, not just, you know, experiments they want to run. And that means that it's part of their daily practice. And that means that it's going to be involved on the server side. So in the early days, we focused on like really core, simple rollout capabilities. Can you do a canary release with LaunchDarkly? Can you do that on Java? We picked Java as sort of like the earliest stack, and I built one of the SDKs for, one of the earliest SDKs we built was for Java. So we focused on Java. We kept the capabilities really simple, but we really focused on sort of that core use case. you know, can I flip a flag off nearly instantaneously if something goes wrong after I deploy without having to roll back the deploy? And that was what the MVP did. I was laser focused on that.
Well then, okay, so you got the MVP, it's laser focused. You work through some of the decisions and trade-offs and you're getting some traction. Tell me how you progress the product from there, how you matured it, and I mean, kind of framed from the standpoint of how did you build your roadmap and figure out this is the next most important thing to build?
There was this sort of like hump that we had to get over, which was we applied like sort of like a lean development methodology for the first cut. And as I said, it was laser focused around that one use case. And we recognized that there was like a second version of the product that needed to do a heck of a lot more. And it involved like a new UI, new capabilities. This was sort of like where we introduced some of the more sophisticated targeting capabilities. So, you know, in LaunchDarkly today, you can, you can do a percentage rollout. You can kill switch a flag, but you can also say things like, if the user is in the early adopters segment, and they've logged in the last 30 days, serve them this variation, otherwise serve them that variation. And that sort of conditional logic with operators and attribute matching and filtering, we had to build that into the second version of the product. And that was sort of like the big hump that we overcame from the MVP to the thing that eventually became the LaunchDarkly that people recognize today. And I would say like one of the things that I wish we'd done is actually, I know it's counterintuitive. A lot of times when you're an entrepreneur, everybody says, be laser focused, do just that one thing. I think we could have been laser focused in terms of the messaging and been a little bit more ambitious in the MVP, because one of the things I've learned in expanding like the MVP out to a full-fledged product is some of the data modeling decisions that you make, like the information architecture of the product, it is super hard to iterate on that. There were phases where we were like, all right, we need a concept of environment so that you can deploy to staging and not have that affect your production rollout. And we had to like re-architect the IA or the data models in the product to accommodate that. And that was an extremely painful process and something that we could have just sort of shortcut all of that if we'd been a little bit more ambitious in terms of like how we modeled things originally.
Was there any part of that where, so you didn't model it that way originally, and you learned it sort of along the way how you would model it? Would you have known everything that you needed to know in the beginning if you were that ambitious, is kind of where my question is.
I don't know in 2015 if we would have, but I think in 2021 the picture is much clearer, and I'll explain that very specifically. I think in 2021 the current generation of developer-focused tools and a lot of B2B tools understand that they need to sell to the enterprise, and what that means specifically is much more well known in 2021 than it was in 2015, and it is much easier for a small startup to build towards the enterprise with some of those capabilities from the outset. So for example, like delegating administration privileges or audit logs or role-based access controls, these are the things that you know you're gonna need to build. There's a site like enterpriseready.io, for example, there's a static site that kind of describes what you need. And I think more and more startups are actually coming to the market with an early MVP that serves more of those enterprise needs because it's cheaper to do and it's better known. And I think if we'd started LaunchDarkly today, we would have gotten a leg up by sort of just assuming we were building from the enterprise from day one.
Well, let's switch to team. So tell me how you built your team and what you looked for in those people to indicate that they were the winning horses to join you.
We were very fortunate in that in the early days of LaunchDarkly, so I came from Atlassian, and Atlassian had an amazing culture, and they were an amazing company. And I was able to pull a number of folks from my early team at Atlassian. So the first two LaunchDarkly engineers who are still with LaunchDarkly today, I'd worked with them for about 5 years at Atlassian. And so we had a really strong working relationship. We knew what the culture was going to look like. We knew a lot about how to work together, and that carried on. We were heavily weighted towards, some of my old teammates at Atlassian in the early days. As we scaled the team up, we sort of had to be a little bit more deliberate about writing down what the characteristics were so that we could find them in new folks that weren't just in our network. And that was something that took, multiple cycles. There are various inflection points in the history of LaunchDarkly where, for example, like recruiting was just scrappy. Nobody had ever heard of us. We can try to sell people on the mission and vision, but everybody's taking a leap to, okay, we're established. We've raised a good bit of money. We have some clear indications externally of success. People are, being more attracted to us. How do we retain that? How do we turn that hiring machine into a real engine? So the definition of like how we built the team has kind of changed over time. The current version of it is very different from what it was then, because we're basically doubling these days, and hiring from 300 to 600 people in a year is a completely different task than your first 12 people, your first 15 people, where you're being extremely deliberate and they've never heard of you, so they're taking a huge risk on you as well.
Well, let's switch to scalability. So did you build this to scale efficiently from day one, or are you fighting this as you grew? And you touched on it a little bit in the beginning, but I want to dive into that topic specifically.
We did build some for scale. Like some of the core decisions around the architecture, there were deliberate product choices that had an understanding of like how customers were going to scale with us. One thing I will say is our ability to scale to request volume without, that sort of has evolved massively over time. So when the first production customer of LaunchDarkly, I remember when they onboarded, we were holding their hands as they walked through the onboarding process. They got us into production and I saw our analytics go from zero requests per second, like totally dark, to six requests per second. And I almost had a heart attack. Six requests per second, how are we gonna possibly manage this volume? I was just with one customer. The current system now is doing 6.5 million requests per second on our analytics pipeline. 49 terabytes of data ingested per day, 20 trillion feature flags. So we scaled from me having a heart attack over six requests per second to that. I would say the lessons I learned is sort of like the behaviors that we built into the system that were customer visible, we built those to scale for day one, sort of like the idea of like you can evaluate a feature flag and that will happen in memory. It will generate an event asynchronously. And we will process that event and we'll batch and process that event. We built that in from sort of day one. We have iterated massively on the backend infrastructure to actually handle that from, various different systems used to process messages to like a queuing system, bringing Amazon Kinesis into the fold, bringing auto scaling into the fold. All of those things were gradual steps that we took over time to get to the point where we're at today and our ability to handle the scale that we're at today. You can change stuff that's on your end. Can't really change stuff that's on the customer's end so rapidly. So you need to, what's in the customer's hands, for us that's like SDKs, because they embed SDKs into their product. If you have a component like that, you need to invest up front in making sure that scales, because you will never be able to get a customer to upgrade on a rapid cadence if there's an emergency. The stuff that happens behind the scenes, all your backend stuff, you can iterate on that, to your heart's content. And you have the ability to do that over time. It doesn't make sense to invest and say, we're gonna handle 6.5 million requests per second from day one when you're building an initial service. You're gonna over-engineer it. You can afford to grow into that over time.
Well, as you step out on the balcony and you look across what you've built with LaunchDarkly, what are you most proud of?
I think I am most proud of the impact that we have for customers. And sort of like transitively, the positive impact that I believe that plays on in the world. So, when you're building a service like LaunchDarkly, you have the opportunity with what we built to change the way people do software development. And that sounds grandiose. But I think, you know, when you talk to our customers, it's a reality that they're facing today. You know, some of our largest customers that are using us, literally every change they put out is protected by a feature flag. It's baked into their development processes. As somebody that spent over 20 years of my career thinking about how to help people build better software faster, that's kind of the holy grail. That's amazing. I'm super excited about that. And our ability to help customers, you know, our ability to help people build better software, I think, impacts the world positively. I mean, I think at the end of the day, if you're in the software industry, you have to, at some level, believe that software is making the world a better place. And if you can help companies build better software, then you can help make the world a better place ultimately. Again, that sounds grandiose, but I think it's actually true. I believe that.
Well, let's flip the script a little bit. Tell me about a mistake you made and how you and your team responded to it.
Well, I alluded to it earlier, but I think one of the mistakes that we made was not investing in the information architecture, the data model, the product adequately at the earliest stages. And we faced it by, I mean, in the most painful and obvious way possible, which was just we had to do these multiple migration efforts to inject new layers into the data model, like a concept of environments, a concept of projects, a concept of like a stronger concept of organizations. So we sort of paid for that mistake pretty early on. I think another mistake we made was we didn't stick to our guns quite enough. And so in the earliest stages, people were telling us, you really need to have experimentation in here, or you really need a mobile offering as well. And so, for example, we hired contractors to do a mobile SDK for LaunchDarkly, and the first version of it was just not very good. It's really hard. Like we realized early on that our SDKs are pretty mission critical, and the quality of them has to be top notch. They have to feel really native. They can't have any bugs. They can't introduce massive performance overhead. And relying on a third party to build that, just it really doesn't work. I think we would have been better off holding off on some of the mobile SDKs for, you know, 6 months until we could bring somebody into LaunchDarkly, a developer in-house to build that and really understand like what we were trying to do with LaunchDarkly and build a great mobile experience for us. And so that came later. We've brought everything in-house. We have over 22 SDKs now from, you know, every mobile platform you can think of, browser, JavaScript, Java, you know, all the way up to some esoteric things like Haskell, Lua, things like that. So it is something that we've really invested in, and we view as one of the most critical pieces of like the engineering that we do here is all of the SDKs that we support.
What does the future look like for the product and for your team?
We think we're really only starting to tap into the value proposition of what feature management is. As I mentioned earlier, we were in a stage 5 years ago where we were sort of like creating the category of feature management, telling people what it was and how it could change the way you do software development. I think at this stage, a good chunk of the market understands what we do. A good number of customers are seeing the value proposition firsthand, and they want to know what's next. What more is there to feature management? What else can it do? And that's one of the things that we're focused on. From a company perspective, we're growing massively. We're still basically doubling year on year on a number of different fronts. One of the things that we're going after that I wouldn't necessarily have anticipated is we've got a lot of traction in the federal sector. And so we're going through a FedRAMP certification now. So we're listed as FedRAMP in process. And we've done a number of the compliance things in the past, like SOC 2, Type 2, and ISO 27001. FedRAMP is a completely different level of difficulty. And we've gone through it. We're spinning up our federal instance. We actually have a good number of federal customers already. And we're excited to bring them onto a more hardened platform, LaunchDarkly platform that they can use.
Let's switch to you, John. Who influences the way that you work? A CEO, a CTO, really any person. Name a person you look up to and why.
Two people that I look up to a ton are the co-founders of Atlassian, Mike Cannon-Brooks and Scott Farquhar. I spent 6 years at Atlassian, and part of the reason I stayed so long was to see what it was like to build and scale an amazing company, and that's what they've done. I joined Atlassian at about 150 people, and I left at about when they were about 2,500 people or so. And that was an incredible series of changes to go through and to observe as an employee. I saw their ability to preserve what made Atlassian special culturally from a product execution standpoint. I saw what it took to do that, and I took a lot of those best practices to launch Sharkly. I think it's pretty safe to say that without being at Atlassian, without observing their leadership, LaunchDarkly wouldn't be what it is today.
Well, we talked about mistakes, and you mentioned, you know, building things in a scalable way in the beginning and the mobile approach, but you know, let's go about it a different spin. If you could go back to the beginning, what would you do differently? Or where would you consider taking a different approach? Doesn't have to be a mistake, can just be, I wish I would have done this way.
It's sort of like a, what would I do differently if we started LaunchDarkly in 2021 answer that I'm going to give you, which is because the world has changed, you know, in the last 7 years. What you did to start a company in 2015 wouldn't fly in 2021. So things that would be different if we started LaunchDarkly today, like assuming that the market category didn't exist and we were coming to things with sort of like some of the market conditions that existed in 2015, or like the vision of what LaunchDarkly would be, but we were executing in 2021. I think you can rely on cloud a lot more. And so, you know, some of the technologies that we tried exploring in the early days in 2015, like we tried to build the LaunchDarkly stack on top of Mesosphere. And that clearly would have been a huge mistake. In 2021, I think you can very safely start and build on top of something like Kubernetes and have a lot of success. I think you can adopt cloud in a much more native way and leverage more high-level primitives that exist in cloud than what we were able to do. We were building things on top of like Docker containers, and there's higher-level abstractions now that you can build on top of. There's more and more SaaS tooling that I think we would have used from day one and trusted. I think those are the dimensions along which like we would have changed things. And a lot of those are not like we did it wrong in 2015. It was those conditions didn't exist in 2015, and they do exist now. And if you're not taking advantage of them, you're going to fall behind everybody else that is doing them.
Well, last question, John. So you're getting on a plane and you're sitting next to a young entrepreneur who's built the next big thing. They're jazzed about it. They can't wait to show it off to the world. Can't wait to show it off to you right there on the plane. What advice do you give that person, having gone down this road a bit?
A few things come to mind. The first is, if you're a technologist especially, don't underestimate how much non-technology weighs into the success or failure of a startup, because it's mostly that, right? Technical execution is one piece of the puzzle, but it's one of many pieces, and there are so many other dimensions that have to work. You can build a great piece of technology, but if your timing isn't right, if your go-to-market message isn't right, if you don't understand who your buyer persona is, that technology is just going to fail. So if you're a technical founder and you don't know how to address those things, find a co-founder that does. I was fortunate enough to find my co-founder, Edith, who understood all of those things. And again, LaunchDarkly wouldn't be where it is without her. It took the conjunction of technology and, you know, timing, market factor, all that other understanding about the market to make LaunchDarkly work. So that's one thing I would share. Another thing that I would share is, you know, as an entrepreneur, assuming you're doing something interesting, you're probably, you know, if you're really innovating, what you're doing, no one's really thought of it before, and no one's thought it could be successful before. So it's probably likely that you're hearing a lot of no's about the quality of your idea or its ability to be something in the marketplace. And part of that, part of being an entrepreneur is sort of like absorbing that and understanding where you're right and everybody else is wrong. When we started LaunchDarkly, everybody told us that this was just experimentation. This was just a feature from an A/B testing tool. I don't understand why it's not more than that. I don't understand why you're targeting people using feature flags and servers. Like, the whole world is mobile applications and web-based applications. So why does the backend matter? And we had answers to those questions. Like, we had a strong vision of what we were going to become, but everybody was telling us no. Funding was really hard for us back in those early days. And I think, you know, there's a fine line here, because at one level you're probably hearing a lot of no's and you have to deal with that. On the other hand, you know, it's very possible that people are right and your startup is failing, or it has failed and you're just being stubborn about it. And so figuring out the distinction between the two is that's kind of the art of being an entrepreneur in a lot of ways, as I see it.
That's good stuff. I appreciate you sharing that. Well, John, thank you for being on the show today. Thank you for telling the creation story of LaunchDarkly.
Thanks, Noah. It was a pleasure.
And this concludes another chapter of Code Story. Code Story is hosted and produced by Noah Laphart. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or the podcasting app of your choice. Support the show on patreon.com/codestory for just $5 to $10 a month. And when you get a chance, leave us a review. Both things help us out tremendously. And thanks again for listening.
Life's better with American Family Insurance, because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.